Lecture 7, The Socialist Calculation Debate.
By the beginning of the 20th century, you should have some sense from the earlier lectures that Marxist thought and socialist thought is facing something of an intellectual crisis. On the theoretical side, it's been torn apart by the marginalist revolution, by Marshall's thinking. The labor theory of value is broadly discredited, and the building blocks just aren't holding up very well. On the empirical side, Marx's particular predictions that labor would become more and more poor, there would be more misery, that the rate of profit would be falling, all those kinds of things aren't actually happening. And he'd written his book, 50 years before. So it's time for socialists and those who sympathize with that point of view to rethink their ground and to rethink where they stand. And where they turn for inspiration is to, in some ways, to John Stuart Mill. Remember, Mill had explicitly focused on the idea that production and distribution could be separated, that you could have efficient production and then distribute it in whichever way you wanted. So, socialists of that time and people with socialist sympathies began to think, would it be possible to have scientific management of the economy, where we could somehow manage scientifically to avoid abuse of workers, avoid low wages, avoid a growing proletariat, and minimize the pain of an economy, but at the same time take advantage of what a market is able to accomplish? What would the management of this system, how would a system like this work? One of the opening shots in this line of thought was fired by the Italian economist Enrico Barone, who's not deeply important to our story, but wrote one of these early essays in 1908. He asked the question in his essay, "How in a collectivist regime ought production to be directed? I do not write for or against collectivism. I assume it that it is established in a certain social group, and I propose to establish certain general lines of the solution which the Ministry of Production ought to give to the vast problem with which it is faced. Many believe they have confuted collectivism when they have shown that some propositions of Marx or of others contain errors and contradictions. But the mere confutation of these propositions has not, in fact, any value, because without falling into such errors and contradictions, one can very well imagine an economic system which would realize the spirit of the Marxist system. Logical absurdities can be eliminated, but it is necessary to have a clear idea what the nature of the system could be after eliminating such absurdities." So, can we take, the socialist thinkers say, can we take the neoclassical economics of Marshall and build something in the Marxist spirit on top of that? And if we do, what would it look like? Well, the Barone's argument in the spirit of economics of this time is heavily mathematical, and I don't particularly recommend trying to read it, but the basic idea should be accessible enough with a little bit of thought. Think about the view of a market economy at this time. There are lots of supply and demand curves for all these different products. So there's supply and demand, they're determining the price through the entire economy. And as Marshall explained, all these work together to reach certain kinds of equilibria. So there's a certain amount of goods produced, there's a certain amount of labor hired, there's a certain amount invested and saved, and the market is determining all of these economic quantities. Now, think about a planned economy with a minister of production, as Barone calls it. Why can't this minister just sit down, figure out what all the prices would be in this planned economy, and put them into place? Why can't the minister control the economy and just have the outcome be what they want it to be? That minister could, in theory, either just choose exactly the market outcome, if that was what they wanted to choose, or if they thought that some tinkering with certain prices or certain wages would change things and produce a better society, then they could tinker with those things and produce another outcome. So, could we have a certain kind of socialism which was based on this notion of supply and demand curves and planning these different relationships? Thinking about all the relationships in the economy, technically figuring out all the supply and demand curves, thinking about how many cars should be produced, how many restaurant meals, how much steel, all those different things, and knitting the whole thing together. Barone writes in his essay, It is conceivable, in fact, that with a vast organization for this work, it would be possible to collect the individual supply and demand schedules for every given series. It is not inconceivable that with these schedules collected, always supposing the technical coefficients are known and invariable, it would be possible by a paper calculation to find a series of equivalents, he really means solving these equations, which become the prices. There is no analytical difficulty about this. It is a problem of very simple linear equations. The difficulty arises, rather, from the very great number of individuals and goods which we must take into account. But it is not inconceivable that with still more arduous work, such difficulty could be overcome. It would be a tremendous, a gigantic work, work therefore taken away from other productive services. But it is not an impossibility. So Baron proposes an idea of a planned society, planned with this knowledge about markets in mind, and using that knowledge of markets to make it work. Well, how would this benefit society? Presumably, the minister of production could experiment with different kinds of production. They could try a little of this, try a little of that, find out what the most efficient thing is. They would have to take workers from products that nobody wants to buy and transfer those workers over into things with other jobs. They would have to arrange that, you know, things get consumed and that they're saving an investment for the future. They would transfer capital to areas where there are new products being invented and things like that, and where it would provide the greatest payoff to society as they determined that payoff. Instead of an invisible hand, in Adam Smith's sense, you would have an extremely visible hand. Now, it's kind of ironical, but as Baron emphasizes, in the practical world, the minister of production will have to make all the decisions the market makes. You might call it different names. You might not call it wages, but you have to determine what workers are going to get paid. You might not call it investment, but you do have to determine where the capital comes from to get invested. So you're going to have to make all these decisions about all the economic categories in the market and think about how they work. Why can't this work? What's the difficulty with making this work? It's a suggestion where you could either do just what the market does, if that's what you desire, or you could improve upon the market and make it somehow better. Well, the critique of this point of view, the main critique of it, comes from a school of economists called the Austrian economists, who, as the name implies, many of them came from Austria. The Austrian school has roots back in the late 19th century, around the time of the marginalists, and they had interesting views about how to think about utility, capital, patterns of production, and different things like that. If I had to sum up the Austrian point of view, which is a little bit difficult to do, I would say that it focuses on a step-by-step-by-step analysis of individual actions and how they work out, rather than sort of thinking about big supply and demand curves reaching equilibrium. So they think about how individual people and how individual firms step-by-step go through their decision-making process. These early views were largely swamped by the impact of Marshall and the neoclassical tradition. But there are certain circumstances, like this argument over socialist calculation, where the step-by-step view of how things translate can be really helpful in thinking about the problems that you're likely to face. Let me give you two examples of Austrian thinkers. One is Ludwig von Mises, another is Friedrich von Hayek. Von Mises lived from 1881 to 1973. Von Hayek was born in 1899 and lived through 1992. So we're getting up toward people who lived well into modern times. Von Mises grew up in Austria. He taught at the University of Vienna for many years, and then, disturbed at the Nazi influence, he fled to Geneva in 1934 and emigrated to New York University in 1940, spent the rest of his career in the United States. He agreed with Baron's point of view that socialists are going to have to think seriously about what people receive for working, the relative prices of goods, you know, how much should be saved and invested, the production process, what inputs will be used, all those kinds of questions. And he wrote an essay in 1920 in response to Baron. To give you a sense of his tone, let me just quote from the very beginning of that essay. He says, "There are many socialists who have never come to grips in any way with the problems of economics, and who have made no attempt at all to form for themselves any clear conception of the conditions which determine the character of human society. They invariably explain how, in the cloud cuckoo lands of their fancy, roast pigeons will in some way fly into the mouths of the comrades. But they omit to show how this miracle is to take place." Really a sweet guy, huh? Von Mises had this combative tone. You know, he liked to get in a good fight and really whack you one.
What about von Hayek?
Von Hayek, who you may have is often just referred to as Hayek, is the greatest 20th century economist in the Austrian tradition. He was also born in Vienna and studied there. He was offered a chair at the London School of Economics in 1931, moved to the University of Chicago in 1950, returned to Europe in the late 1960s at the University of Freiburg in Germany and the University of Salzburg in Austria, and he won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1974. What did people like Mises and Hayek think about this whole idea of socialism, of planned socialism, in the way that Baron laid it out? Von Mises wrote the first essay in 1920, and then both Mises and Hayek battled on this subject for probably the next 50 years. Fundamentally, they said what we want to do when we think about the market is think about the market as a mechanism for calculating and coordinating what happens in the economy. To make an economic decision, you have to decide how much will you buy, or to make a production decision, how much of a resource will be used. You have to think about using the resource in one way or another way. Should I buy this or that? Should I hire a worker? Should I buy a machine? How should I balance things out? You have to think about how much do people want to use this product? Where might technological breakthroughs be occurring? In other words, the world is a complicated place, and economic calculations involve thinking about a large number of things. Mises wrote in his 1920 essay, "One may anticipate the nature of the future socialist society. There will be hundreds and thousands of factories in operation. Very few of these will be producing wares ready for use. In the majority of cases, what will be manufactured will be unfinished goods and production goods, which will be used then by other firms. All these concerns will be interrelated. Every good will go through a whole series of stages before it's ready for use. In the ceaseless toil and moil of this process, however, the administration will be without any means of testing their bearings. It will never be able to determine whether a given good has not been kept for a superfluous length of time in the necessary process of production, or whether work and material have not been wasted in its completion. Why won't they be able to tell? Because they won't have any prices to guide them. If they're dictating everything, and they're setting all the prices themselves, they won't have any signals to say, this is profitable, this is not, this is what people want and people don't want. They won't have the market to coordinate and calculate those things for them. Mises' point is, it doesn't matter if you sort of say broadly, you know, there should be a lot of cars or something like that. You have to think how many cars, how much steel, how produced, and all those kinds of decisions. And without some kind of guidance from the market to make those decisions, it's just not clear how you will be making them. So, one big difficulty with the market socialist idea is the notion that there's so many decisions to make and they're all interrelated with each other, and doubt as to whether a guiding brain can make them. As von Mises puts it in his typical delicate way, we have the spectacle of a socialist economic order floundering in the ocean of possible and conceivable economic combinations without the compass of economic calculation. In the socialist commonwealth, every economic change becomes an undertaking whose success can neither be appraised in advance nor later retrospectively determined. There is only groping in the dark. Socialism is the abolition of a rational economy. So he argues that if you take everything over, you're steering without signposts. You're not going to know how things ought to work out. By contrast, let's think about a market process and a competition process. And the Austrians have a distinctive view of competition and markets, which is separate from that idea of calculation. Their notion is that we have to have the market to calculate precisely because we don't know what outcomes are likely to occur. Hayek wrote in a 1945 essay, "If anyone really knew all about what economic theory calls the data, competition would indeed be a very wasteful method of securing adjustment to these facts. It is not surprising that some people," he means like Baron, "have been led to the conclusion we can either wholly dispense with the market, or its results should be used only as a first step towards securing an output of goods and services, which we can manipulate, correct, or redistribute in any manner we wish." But then he goes on to say, the whole point is, we don't know how it's going to come out. We don't know what products are going to be successes. We don't know how things should be done in the most efficient way. Against this, Hayek writes, it's salutary to remember that wherever the use of competition can be rationally justified, it is on the ground that we do not know in advance the facts that determine the actions of competitors. In sports or in examinations, no less than in the award of government contracts or of prizes for poetry, it would clearly be pointless to arrange for competition if we were certain beforehand who would do best. I propose to consider competition as a procedure for the discovery of such facts, as without resort to it would not be known to anyone, or at least would not be utilized. So he argues that competition is a method for discovering information and for encouraging people to act in certain ways which otherwise you have no way of finding out. This is, of course, linked to Jevons' idea about utilitarianism and the idea that we can't see what people want. Instead, we have to let the market work it out and see what their behavior is in the market. We can't see what would be most efficient. We have to let businesses compete with each other to try and find out. In this view, this Austrian view, prices should be viewed as an information signal about what's happening in the market and a way of distributing information about what's going on. Later in that same 1945 paper, Hayek discusses a problem of what happens if there's a shortage of tin. He says, maybe there's a shortage of tin because something happened in the mines. Maybe there's a shortage of tin because there was some technological discovery. Who knows? Who cares? The market reacts to this shortage by making the price get higher. Then when people are using tin, as the price gets higher, they have an incentive to cut back on their use, to find alternatives, to substitute in other ways, and to sort of avoid using tin. And particularly, the people who have the least value for it will be the ones who give it up most quickly. And Hayek emphasizes, you know, it's kind of nice that you don't have to know why the price of tin went up. There didn't have to be a government board that had an inquiry into why is the price of tin higher. You also didn't have to have a bunch of government people say, okay, given all the uses for tin in the economy, now what do we do to bring down the price of tin? You don't have to worry about those things with the market. All you need to know is the price went up and I react to that. So the price is a way of compressing a lot of information. It carries all sorts of possible information and then encourages the appropriate economic response. He says we must look at the price system as a mechanism for communicating information if we want to understand its real function. And precisely, he would argue, the reason why it's wrong to control prices or to set prices is they stop being able to convey that kind of information. They don't tell you what's going on. Now, this is a wonderful mechanism for thinking about how the world gets planned. Hayek emphasizes that a lot of people at the time argued, look, we can't just have everything running amok and just going all over the place. We have to plan what's going to happen in society. We have to think about things in an orderly fashion. And Hayek's response to that was, there's different kinds of planning. He says, the real question is, who is to do the planning? It is about this question that all the dispute about economic planning centers. This is not a dispute over whether planning is to be done or not. It is a dispute as to whether planning is to be done centrally, by one authority for the whole economic system, or the planning is to be divided among many individuals. Planning in the specific sense, in which it's often used in the contemporary controversy, often means central planning, direction of the whole economic system according to one unified plan. Competition, on the other hand, means decentralized planning by many very separate persons. So when you think about the world being planned, it would be wrong to think about, you know, socialism is planned, capitalism is unplanned. They're both planned. It's a question of who has information, how they act upon that information, and how they think about the planning that's going on. In fact, Hayek makes, I think, a stronger and more interesting point when he says that, in fact, it's often really a good thing if you don't plan and if you don't fully understand how things happen. He says that often in our modern society, we sort of say, well, we have to understand this. We have to know why the price went up. We have to know why the price changed. We have to know why people are doing things in the way they're doing them. He quotes Alfred North Whitehead on this subject in another connection. Whitehead wrote, "It is a profoundly erroneous truism, repeated by all copybooks and by eminent people when they are making speeches, that we should cultivate the habit of thinking what we are doing. The precise opposite is the case. Civilization advances by extending the number of operations which we can perform without thinking about them." That's a deep thought, I think. Hayek's comment is, this is of profound significance in the social field. He says a lot of the reason people complain about prices all the time is that we want to feel like we're always thinking about them and they're under our control. But when you think about all of life, I mean, isn't it better in some ways that you don't understand precisely how a microwave oven works, or precisely how an internal combustion engine works, or precisely how a high-speed mechanical loom works, or precisely how a television works? I mean, if you have to worry about how everything works, you would spend nothing but thinking about that. You would have no time to live your own life and focus on your own part of the division of labor. What the market does is, by compressing the information down into the price and by letting people just worry about the price, it means that we don't have to collect all this information. We don't have to think about it. And in that way, Hayek would argue, and Mies, it is an extraordinary gain for society that we don't have to worry about these things. What are the implications of this idea of the importance of information and prices for how you would see the economy as a whole? A couple of common implications are that it implies that there's going to be a lot of competition out there, because people will get different kinds of information, they'll use information in different ways. Some will be better at it, some will be worse. And so the Austrians tend to be not very worried about this idea that one big firm will control everything in the style that Marx was worried about, because they believe, you know, one firm might be ahead for a while, but in this shifting world of taking advantage of different kinds of information, they won't be on top forever. So they believe competition is actually quite resilient and not very likely to be overtaken by monopoly. Another problem that they raise, and a problem which makes sense to a lot of people today, is it's the question of who will watch the watchers. You can't just assume, presumably, that the socialist planners will do everything because they feel like it's a good idea. The socialist planners are going to be people, and as people, they are going to make decisions based in their own self-interest. They may not be very smart people. They may be corrupt people. They may have all the problems and more of current contemporary business people. So, for example, Mies wrote, "All socialist systems, including that of Karl Marx and his orthodox supporters, proceed from the assumption that in a socialist society, a conflict between the interests of the particular and the general could not possibly arise. Everybody will act in his own interest, in giving his best, because he participates in the product of all economic activity." The obvious objection is that the individual is very little concerned whether he himself is diligent and enthusiastic, and it is of greater moment to him that everybody else should be. This fact is completely ignored or is insufficiently dealt with by them. And when you think about socialist planning and some of the problems of totalitarian countries, clearly one of the problems is people don't want to worry so much about working hard. They want to worry about whether their neighbors are getting too much, whether their neighbors are working hard, whether their neighbors are cheating. And that kind of an insight into human nature is deeply Austrian. So the Austrians raise a number of tough questions about this idea of socialist planning, this notion that all you need to do is have socialist planning and the economy will work out well. But this, of course, as so often in intellectual stories, is not the end of the story. These are good, tough, legitimate questions the Austrians raise, but of course, the socialists and the market socialists, as they've come to be called, have answers to them, and those answers are real ones. They begin by saying, look, these notions about totalitarianism, about Soviet communism, that's not what we're talking about here. It's never what we were talking about. It's not what Marx was talking about, and it's wrong to judge us by that kind of standard. Our notion of how a socialist market would work is different. We're going to let there be a market. We're going to let everyone determine how much they want to buy. We're going to let people determine where they want to work. We're going to let free markets pretty much rule in terms of what's bought and sold and the labor market. In this sense, you know, we think Marshall and the neoclassical thinkers are right. We're going to let markets rule on that side of things. What we think socialism means is that the means of production, by which we mean plant, equipment, factories, the flow of capital, that's going to be socially controlled and socially owned. And so socially, we will have to make big decisions about how many factories that get built and means of production, but we're not going to try and regulate the prices that are charged between people or who wants to work in what area. We're going to plan the big means of production. We're going to let the market rule in the rest of it. Broadly speaking, this is what modern academic Marxists would be arguing when they argue for a version of Marxism. And in a way, it's not dreadfully inconsistent to say this. I mean, after all, Marx thought of himself as a follower of Adam Smith. You know, the argument would be Marx had some good ideas. You know, there's a progression here from Smith through Marx through Marshall, and now we come out with a new kind of socialist thinking. So, I mean, I think that's a reasonable way to go. They know that there's a calculation problem, Marxists do, and they need to think about how we would solve it. To give you one person who sort of epitomizes this point of view and gives you a way of sort of putting it into more human terms, I'd like to think about Oscar Lange. He was an economist born in 1904 and lived until 1965, born in Poland, studied at the University of Krakow, spent 1936 to 1945 in the United States, mainly at the University of Chicago, went back to Poland after the war in 1945 and became a professor at the University of Warsaw. But he was also active in politics. He was Poland's ambassador to the United Nations. He was a member of parliament. He was a member of the state council. In a way, just as Colbert, the mercantilist writer, had a chance to put mercantilist writing into practice, Lange had a chance to put market socialist teaching into practice, because he's working in Poland in the context of Soviet control of that economy after World War II. In 1937 and 38, he put forward the market socialist position in a famous series of essays, which I believe were later combined into one book, and you can buy them in a single book if you want. Near the beginning, he offers a good jab at Mies. He says, "Socialists have good reason to be grateful to Professor Mies, the great devil's advocate of their cause. For it was his powerful challenge that forced the socialists to recognize the importance of an adequate system of economic accounting to guide the allocation of resources in a socialist economy." And he goes on for a little bit and says, "We should be so grateful to him. He helped us recognize how important it was to think about this question, both as an expression of recognition for the great service rendered by him and as a memento of the prime importance of his work. A statue of Professor Mies ought to occupy an honorable place in the great hall of the Ministry of Socialization or the Central Planning Board of the Socialist State. I am afraid, however, that Professor Mies would scarcely enjoy what seems the only adequate way to repay our debt of recognition, and it is difficult to blame him for not doing so. First, he might have to share his place with the great leaders of the socialist movement, and the company might not suit him. And then, to complete the misfortune, a socialist teacher might invite his students in a class on dialectical materialism to go and look at the statue, which made even the staunchest of bourgeois economists unwittingly serve the proletarian cause." You can just see him giving Mies a good jab as he does all that. So what's his argument? What's his argument about how market socialism works? Well, he begins off just by restating the argument for market socialism very much in the terms that Baron did. This is possible. We can lay things out. Sure, we won't get it right the first time, but we'll try different things. We'll grope, we'll establish different things, and eventually it will kind of work out. He writes, "The Central Planning Board performs the functions of the market. It establishes the rules for combining factors of production, for choosing the scale of output of a plant, for determining the output of an industry, and so on and so on. And finally," he argues, "it fixes the prices so as to balance the quantity supplied and demanded of each commodity. It follows the substitution of planning for the functions of the market is quite possible and workable." And that's basically just Baron's argument one more time. Now, he then says, okay, if we can do what the market does, what's the case, what's the argument for having us do it? If all we're doing is repeating the market, then maybe we should just let the market go. We would have to do something different or better. Well, what are some of the things that we might be able to do different or better? He proposes a number of them. One is, he says, maybe we could get to the market price faster. Instead of having all these jumps like you might have in a capitalist economy, we could get to the market price sooner. He says, there's not the slightest reason why a trial and error procedure similar to a competitive market could not work in a socialist economy. Indeed, it seems this trial and error procedure would, or at least could, work much better in a socialist economy than it does in a competitive market. For the Central Planning Board has a much wider knowledge of what's going on in the whole economic system than any private entrepreneur can ever have, and consequently may be able to reach the right equilibrium price by a much shorter series of trials than a competitive market actually does. So, the market, but even better. Another reason that he gives is that it could lead to a more fair distribution of income, that we could pay workers more, we could make sure that we don't have extremely poor workers and extremely rich workers, but instead we could pay equal wages to everyone according to their need, as he uses the term. Yet another idea. The society organized in this way could take into account social costs, like the safety and the security of the workers and the number of jobs they've got. He writes, an economic system based on private enterprise can take only a very imperfect account of the alternatives sacrificed in production. Most important alternatives, like the life, security, and health of the workers, are sacrificed without being accounted for as a cost of production. A socialist economy would be able to put all the alternatives into its economic accounting. Thus, it would evaluate all the services rendered by production and take into account all the alternatives sacrificed. As a result, it will be able to convert its social overhead costs into prime costs and avoid social waste. So his notion is, you could take into account whether you're getting workers injured or ill or sick, and fold that into the costs of production. And that would be a more efficient way of running things than just letting those costs happen. He argues that you could have a situation where you can avoid monopoly capitalism. Remember, in Marx's view, the plants are getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And he argues that in capitalism, you're not going to have competition. You're just going to have these giant monopolists getting larger and larger and larger. So he argues, actually, if you have the government come in and run things, you can actually get more competition than you're likely to have if what you have is these giant monopolists. Because after all, they've got almost no competition at all. So he argues capitalism is not competition. Capitalism is monopoly. And actually, socialism is likely to be closer to some ideal form of competition in the way that a model, an economic model of someone like Marshall might draw it up. He argues that if you have socialist planning, the economy as a whole can have smaller swings. It won't be bouncing up and down the way Marx predicted that a capitalist economy would. After all, he says, a private entrepreneur has to close his plant when he incurs grave losses. In a socialist economy, a mistake is a mistake and has to be corrected. But in making the correction, all the alternatives gained and sacrificed can be taken into account. Mistakes can be localized. So, you know, if you have to shut down a plant, well, maybe you have to shut it down. But you could keep it open for a while if, socially speaking, that was a good thing to do. You wouldn't have to close it down instantly, as capitalism will require you to do. And he also argues that in a capitalist society, you're going to have Marxist-type unemployment. New technology keeps getting introduced, and as that new technology keeps getting introduced, people are put out of work. He argues that process of introducing new technology can happen more smoothly and with less pain if you have a socially planned economy. So you'd have less unemployment and less disruption for that reason as well. So that's his case for why you should step in, you should have social planning of the economy. What are potential problems of his case? Well, there are a few that we can toss in, and Lange was very aware of these problems, and he discusses them in his essay. One is, it's a little hard to think about how savings happens in this economy and how investment happens. If you let people save up stuff, then you're going to have some people who get rich because they save a lot, and other people who don't save very much at all. If you do save something, where do you invest it? If all the banks are owned by the government and the government is planning all the investment, there's not going to be a stock market. There's not going to be bonds. You know, where are you going to put your money? Are you just going to put it, you know, under a mattress? How will investment work? And how will you funnel money from savers to industry? How will the state determine what a good investment is? If there are 50 different places you could put a plant, and 50 different ways every plant could produce something, and 50 different products every plant could produce, how are you going to decide what the best one is over and over? How much experimenting are you going to do? In a famous comment, Lange says, a real danger of socialism is the bureaucratization of economic life, not the impossibility of coping with the problem of allocation of resources. It's not that it's impossible to do this, but by the time we get all these bureaucrats trying to decide everything, even Lange will say socialism could well have a problem there. Effectively, he ends up arguing the following. He says that in capitalism, you've got shareholders and boards of directors. And as we all know, that's not the best way of controlling anything. If you've got giant corporations, giant numbers of shareholders, giant boards of directors, the corporate executives can pretty much do what they want. Lange says that's what capitalism is. On the other hand, he says if you have democratic control over socialist planning, democracy will be a better way of controlling those businesses than shareholder control would be. And phrased that way, that's an arguable point. Is it really true? Historically, socialist countries have had a terrible time making democratic decisions about things. Often, the minister of planning has been under far less control than someone who's actually tried to run a plan. And it's hard to imagine that you would have a bunch of democratic legislators overseeing millions and millions of business decisions. When push gets to shove, Lange sort of does the good Marxist thing. He throws up his hands and says, okay, we just need to have revolutionary courage about all this. Caution was the virtue of 19th century economists who were concerned with minor improvements in the existing economic system. But the economist who is called upon to advise a socialist government faces a different task, and the qualities needed for this task are different too. There exists only one economic policy which he can commend to a socialist government as likely to lead to success. This is the policy of revolutionary courage. I mean, I'm not big on rhetoric. That seems to me largely silly. But that's sort of what it comes down to in the end. Give it a try, see what happens. Well, who won? We have this argument going on back and forth over the decades between the market socialists and between the Austrians. I think the answer of who won has actually evolved over time. The Austrians, of course, thought they won. They always thought they won. But from the 1940s and the 1950s, even through the 60s, they were probably the only ones who thought they'd won. Pretty much everyone else thought that Lange had showed socialist planning could work, that it did have some potential advantages, and that the real problem was, how do you implement it? And so in terms of what was possible, a lot of people felt that Lange had essentially won the argument. I ran into one book written in the 1930s where a U.S. economics professor wrote, "The burden of proof has been shifted to the capitalist economy, which must now show why it should not be replaced by a socialist one, in view of the evidence, feasibility, and superiority of the socialist one." And a lot of modern thinking in the 30s and 40s and 50s was socialism is clearly better. Of course, there are these tricky problems of how do we implement it, but, you know, theoretically and practically, it should prove to be better. By the 1980s, a sort of revisionist current had set in, and there was a sense that instead the Austrians had actually won the debate. To a modern ear, when you listen to some of the things that Lange says, they begin to sound a little bit to me like pandering. I mean, everyone will be treated the same according to their need. What if your need isn't the same? What if one person's more productive than another? He's sort of just sliding past things like that. Are you really saying you won't have to close plants? Sort of sounds like it sometimes, but you know they will have to sometimes. This argument that capitalism tends to monopoly. Well, says who exactly? I mean, it's been 150 years since Marx wrote. It's not clear that we've reached monopoly yet. It's not clear over the last 50 years that the trend is even in that direction. We worry more about bureaucrats and what their incentives are, and that question of why would they do this right? Why will they get their information? How will it work out? How quickly will they be able to respond? Will they be spending years and years working on things? Why will entrepreneurs do anything in this socialist system? Where will new technology come from? In a way, the dispute turns on the meaning of the word calculation. If you just mean, can we calculate and run a socialist economy, the answer is clearly yes. Planned economies, like the Soviet economy, worked in some level for years and years and years. They didn't work perfectly. One can even argue they didn't work very well, or they worked with a great deal of pain, but they did work. So in that sense, socialist calculation can work. If that's as far as you go, then you would have to concede that Lange won the debate. But it's also hard now to look at it and say, if what you mean by worked is, does it produce a better outcome? Does it produce all these extra gains that Lange was promising? You'd have to say, well, no, it doesn't seem to produce all those extra gains. My guess is that the reason that the feelings about who won and lost the debate have changed is really just a change in our times. During the 30s and 40s and 50s, there was a sense that the Soviet Union was up and coming. It was a new way of doing things. They really had some truth that we were struggling to get a hold of. And of course, by the 1980s, when that country disappears and breaks up, we begin to feel like, oh, well, you know, actually, we all know there was never really anything there. But the challenge from socialism was really a lot stronger than that. oddly enough, I think that there are a lot of commonalities, actually, between the Austrians and the market socialists. In a way, both of them are very critical of neoclassical economics, but from different directions. The Austrians dislike the idea of neoclassical economics because it sort of says the whole world is an engine. There's supply and demand curves, it all comes together, it all reaches equilibrium. The Austrians are sort of like, no, there's this information and people are reacting to information. There's a step-by-step-by-step process here. And just saying it's all in a balanced equilibrium is not really the way the economy works. The market socialists dislike neoclassical economics because they feel like it provides a rhetoric which supports free markets, even though you would need to have more government control in various ways. In fact, from both points of view, many of the problems of capitalism are the same ones. You know, how do we fight against things like pollution? How do we deal with problems when there are economies of scale? How do we plan for the future? And how does planning for the future happen? How do we think about risks? How do we think about the incentives workers get? How do we assure the quality of goods? Both sets of thought have to think about those questions. And I think it's true that if you look back at Alfred Marshall, those are questions where he's a little vague. In other words, both the market socialists and the Austrians want to get down into the nitty-gritty problems and see how the market works out resolving them. In our modern time, it would be fair to say, you know, capitalism has won over socialism, but I think it's useful to remember that this victory is in some ways less complete than we might think. There are, after all, many, many, many versions of capitalism out there. There's U.S. capitalism, there's Japanese capitalism, there's Swedish capitalism, there's German capitalism. And those have extremely different social institutions, extremely different kinds of laws, different kinds of financial systems and banking, different kinds of social control over the economy. So these differences are large enough that I think it would be wrong just to say that capitalism is one flavor and that capitalism has triumphed, and that's all there is to it. The truth is that a lot of the concerns of the socialist philosophers, like how do we deal with unemployment? How do we deal with what happens when we need to shift from one company to another? Do we give notice to our workers? Do we pay unemployment benefits? All those kinds of things are concerns that they drew out. The modern consensus, I would say, given again that the consensus implies there are some people out there who disagree, is that if you say, should the government control the economy, yes or no, you would have to say the answer is no. That the power of markets has been broadly demonstrated over the last century. The Austrians are right in some sense, that markets are an extremely powerful way of bringing together information from all sorts of different places. You think back to Adam Smith's example of the woolen coat and all of the products that went into that. And you think about what would it take to have a government agency that literally planned every step in production processes all over the economy. It's just hard to imagine that working very well in a complex modern economy. On the other hand, I would say that the question of should the government intervene, yes or no, is not an interesting question, as most absolute questions are not interesting questions. The interesting question is, under what circumstances should the government intervene? The market socialists and modern Marxists would say there's a lot of room for intervention. More liberal folks would tend to say, well, the government should only intervene in a few areas. But what we're really doing is weighing and balancing different types of intervention and how they might work in different circumstances, and trying to decide, well, we can let the power of markets do what markets do well, but come up with some way of changing them when they do badly. You remember that John Stuart Mill said that all that you tried to think about when you thought about government intervention was the practicality of it, whether it worked, and that it was hard to come up with firm rules that said yes or no. The dispute between market socialists and Austrians is reflective of that dispute over what should happen that carries down through the profession today.